This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Last Tuesday, President Donald Trump stated that he'd block federal funding for colleges and universities that, quote, allow illegal protests on their campuses. He also promised expulsion and/or arrest of students who participate in such protests, and international students so involved would be deported. Student-led protests on high school, college, and university campuses have a long history in the United States, including here in the St. Louis region. Andrew De La Salas is a senior at WashU. He's studying international affairs with minors in sociology and Asian American studies. He's a former member of student government. We spoke with Andrew last year when he was one of 100 people arrested at an anti-war protest where students, faculty, and community members demanded that the university stop investing in Boeing because it supplies weapons to Israel. He says President Trump's recent executive orders and his announcement that he'd crack down on student protests has him worried for the future.
I'm going to graduate in May. I'm going to walk across the stage and I'm going to get a diploma from the same university that arrested me. And I'm fortunate enough to know that there are people who recognize the injustice of that situation. And I always thought that I would be able to go work in the Department of Justice or for the Office of Civil Rights or even pursue education policy. But those are the same areas that are either being weaponized or defunded. So I'm not sure where my own future is going to look like. I'm not sure where I'm going to be able to take the lessons from my education, the ones learned both as a student activist and in the classroom. But it leaves me concerned. It leaves me uncertain. But I guess just at a broader level, I'm not sure what protest is going to look like on college campuses, especially if it means that funding is in jeopardy. And that's really what sustains a lot of these research institutions and what allows for the fomentation of a lot of these different ideas. If that comes under threat, we might start to see an increased chilling effect on different universities, and the same kinds of ones that we've already seen a drastic increase of in the past couple years alone.
Because he was arrested by WashU police last spring, Andrew would face a one-semester deferred suspension if he breaks any university rules. He says that his activist work has led him to be more careful about his off-campus activities as well.
I know that I'm not able to take any of the same kinds of actions that I took last year, but I know that any actions off campus are likely going to be subject to a lot more surveillance. So that's going to require me to take some more safety protocols, make sure that folks know where I am, what kind of resources I have, what kind of backup plans I can take. It's a pretty scary time for people who are interested and passionate about issues of justice, racial equity, and frankly, democracy.
Andrew is Filipino-American. Over the past year, he's been working on a thesis on the martial law period in the Philippines in the 1970s. He says he's noticed parallels between the actions of President Ferdinand Marcos and how many Filipinos were feeling at that time and what is happening in the U.S. today.
One president decided to expand executive power slowly and then very drastically. There's a lot of different sectors of society that supported him because they stood to benefit materially. And I was doing archive research over the summer when I first saw the Supreme Court release their decision on the U.S. v. Trump that expanded his powers, expanded technically the president's powers. But I guess, you know, since then, it's been surreal to watch a lot of this unfold historically in my own family's history, and then to see it play out on the news, on the headlines. And really, every time I open the news app, it just reminds me of this creeping feeling of authoritarianism that doesn't feel like it has any place in the democracy I grew up in.
Andrew says he found it notable that President Trump said he plans to crack down on college and university protests in particular.
Because it was student protesters who were really leading a lot of the forefront in the 1970s against this dictator, President Marcos. And they were the ones who were saying that we need more reforms, there needs to be a change in the economy, because this economic model clearly isn't serving all of us. I mean, people like to point to the price of eggs, but again, we have billionaires in the White House when people can't even afford some of their basic necessities. So I guess that's one parallel, is the ridicule of student protests, especially as they're the ones who are drawing attention to the economic issues.
Andrew added that while it can be tempting to focus on the actions of one person, one politician, he feels it is important to understand the coalitions behind such figures, including President Trump and his supporters.
And that includes everybody from tech billionaires to Christian nationalists. And the thing that ends up uniting them is their desire for control over sectors that were previously out of reach for them. You know, Elon Musk couldn't reach into the pocketbook of WashU, but he knows that he could maybe intimidate them if he threatens to withhold their funding. And Stephen Miller knows that he can't maybe force WashU to release lists of certain students, but he knows that he could potentially order other policies through the Department of Education or other positions that he has influence over and end up hurting students that way. So this recent moment, I guess, that the president announced, I see as just a continuum of this particular coalition. And I think it requires a lot of folks, both student activists, former student activists, and like-minded people to start working together, to start talking, because the only thing that we can get out of this little bubble of fear is to start to create a community of a lot more joy and of a lot more resistance.
That was WashU senior Andrew De Las Alas reacting to President Donald Trump's plan to withhold funding from colleges and universities that allow what he referred to as illegal protests. Joining us to talk about the implications of President Trump's proposals for dealing with campus protests and students, participants, as well as the actions taken by the Trump administration over the last few days, we welcome Chris Tinson. Chris is a history professor and chair of African American Studies at St. Louis University and is a scholar of activist movements. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Great to see you again.
So let's start with the recent developments. Now, what President Trump proposed last Tuesday, and this is what producer Emily Woodbury talked with Andrew De Las Alas about, that post was on Truth Social, was not an executive order. But since then, the Trump administration has taken up two of those proposals, and on Friday, it pulled $400 million in federal funding to Columbia University, where pro-Palestinian students have engaged in protests against war in Gaza. And then just yesterday, U.S. Department of Homeland Security agents arrested a Columbia University graduate student who is a permanent U.S. resident for his role in leading campus protests. So that's a lot. What do you make of this, Chris?
Well, first off, I loved hearing the student from WashU talk about what's at stake and what students are forced to do if they care about, you know, global issues and also domestic issues. So they're intertwined at this point. But the takeaway so far is that we are living through the production of a culture of fear in which the powerful entity, in this case our presidential regime, thrives off of that cultural fear. They want people to feel vulnerable. They want people to feel under threat. They want people to feel that they're constantly being watched and surveilled. And some of that we do ourselves, right? Because we're on social media so much, it's kind of like these systems that are purported to be, you know, freedom of speech vehicles actually are tools of surveillance in many ways. So people can go back and look at your history. People can see what you liked, what you retweeted, what you posted yourself. And so these things can then be used against you. it's the very thing that we teach against at the university. We're trying to inculcate students with a sense of courage and a sense of commitment and a sense of purpose beyond themselves. Mm-hmm. And so this culture of fear runs directly counter to that energy that they're trying to produce, and the energy that actually got Andrew, the student that we heard from, mm-hmm. got him hemmed up and embroiled in this stuff.
There has been a good deal of chatter since last Tuesday who oppose what Trump and his administration are doing. And there is much urging that folks are doing to not obey in advance. So this speaks to what you're talking about as far as the culture of fear. How successful do you think that has been? And I think it's tempting perhaps to think of this as, this is what's happening now. Mm-hmm. How long has it taken us to get to this point?
Yeah. No, universities have always been in the crosshairs because they are the spaces where a lot of competing ideals exist. And in many senses, they are microcosms of American society. They should be the spaces where we can sit in the classroom, disagree on a piece of material, and figure out a way to ask questions about it, exercise our intellectual muscles, teach people how to do archival research, how to balance evidence and all this kind of stuff. And those are the kind of tools that we are giving students. So upon graduation, those are things that all students should have. The university is, because of its vulnerable space in terms of endowments, right? As I joke with my students, everybody has a price, right? And so the universities are like, we don't want our endowments touched. And if you threaten the endowments, then you threaten to close the doors of the university. So they see the 1+1 on that. But I think that it's something that they're not going to be able to win at, because I don't think that you can appease this energy ever. I think this energy, it feeds on that fear. It expands through that fear and that vulnerability. And so the more that it knows that it can eat through that vulnerability, it'll look for more things to take. Mm-hmm. And so universities trying to be ahead of the curve, it's a temporary fix, but it's not a long-term fix.
One of the things that has happened, the first thing to happen on Friday, was that withdrawal of federal funds. $400 million is no small amount. I mean, on average, how much federal funding do colleges and universities receive?
I've heard from my friends who rely on a lot of what we call indirects. It's upwards of 40% of some budgets in some spaces. So you're talking about a significant number. I heard some schools stand to lose upwards of $200 million a year or something like this. That's incredible. That's an incredible amount. But what people don't understand is that the way the universities are being talked about is that they're these elite institutions that no one has access to. But that's actually counter to what American Academy used to be in American society. It was a space of upward mobility. Mm-hmm. It was a space of deepening one's commitments and deepening one's ties to social justice or to global governance, if you will. And so I think that those are things that are also at stake, right, when you go at people's endowments or these universities' endowments. So it's a pretty significant hit if that is the case, if they actually do shut the faucet off on that money.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a very quick break here, but we will continue this conversation when we come back. We're talking again today about the implications of President Trump's threatening to take federal funding from colleges and universities that permit, quote, illegal protests on campus, and what some of the implications are also of recent actions that have been taken on student protest and what that means for American democracy. We'll be back very shortly. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with Chris Tinson, history professor and chair of African American Studies at St. Louis University. We've been discussing campus protests, specifically the Trump administration's blocking federal funding for college and university campuses that, quote, allow illegal protests on campus and taking action against students who participate in such protests. We have caller Sanvi from Seattle on the line with something to add to this discussion. Sanvi, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Hi, this is Sanvi.
Oh, please go ahead.
Yeah, things have honestly been pretty scary. People have been afraid of showing support for Palestine and other social movements on campus. As you all were talking about earlier, with the recent cuts to funding that Columbia is facing, as well as the detention of activist Muhammad Khalil, I think university administration is going to be taking far more egregious actions. And as a result, people are understandably going to be more afraid than they already are. However, even with this fear, me and other activists feel it. It's not a time for despair at all. Things will get worse, but we won't be stopped. That won't stop us from celebrating, resisting, and fighting for liberation. And that's not something any politician can take away from us.
Mm-hmm. And Sanvi, you are a student at WashU. What are some of the things that you have been hearing from fellow students that you have engaged in activist work with there?
Yeah, in terms of what I've been hearing from other students, it's honestly been a lot of confusion with the amount of misinformation that's been spread about people who support movements like Palestine, fear that they're anti-Semitic, which is absolutely bogus. And so there's been a lot of work to try and increase political consciousness on campus and work to kind of deconstruct some of the myths that have been fed through the media and campus administration alike.
Mm-hmm. Sanvi, thank you so much for calling today. Chris, what is it that is coming to mind for you as you hear Sanvi?
Well, I'm encouraged by her resolve. And I think that kind of a position is actually defending the values and the mission of the university. And so I think a lot of university administrators are saying, well, you know, we are trying to uphold our values, uphold our mission, uphold the things that we know we do well, but trying to thread that needle of also silencing protest, right? Mm-hmm. And so the interesting part about the university spaces is that they used to always have a space where, you know, what we call the commons, where you could come and people would protest or they would dance or there would be some, you know, food and engagement and community building. And those spaces are being heavily policed now, right? So those spaces are now unwelcome spaces, spaces that people disrupt. And universities have historically, unfortunately, relied on campus police and sometimes even military police to interrupt student protests throughout history. I mean, mm-hmm. we've seen it in the 1960s with the anti-Vietnam protests around the country, and this is just a redo of that, unfortunately. So it's a very difficult time to, try to stand behind the questions of free speech and democracy on university campuses. But the hope is that through the students, that the university will see the value in leaning more in that direction than silencing and conformity.
Mm-hmm. We also have Penelope who is calling in. Penelope, what is on your mind as it relates to this the crackdown on what President Trump has called illegal campus protests?
Yeah, so I mean, this is Penelope. I'm a WashU student. I'm a junior. I think to me there's a few very interesting pieces of what's happening here. First of all, is I think this is both a moment, but also kind of a moment in the making of the campus crackdowns and anti-protest work we've seen from the Biden administration previously, and then also just generally that has been rising as a sentiment over kind of the last 5-10 years. But then also I think there's a very, and I think this is one of the pieces where the fear comes from, of it's unclear what is going to be continued to call protests and what's going to be called politics. I know as a queer person myself and someone with a lot of queer friends, a lot of friends of color, like, there's this worry also that just the very existence, the very lives that we lead are going to end up being called protests or politics and then restrained similarly.
Mm-hmm. Penelope, thank you so much for your call.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
So I think that's an excellent point because this goes to what I was saying earlier. There is no end in sight. It's just, you know, whack what you can while it's in front of you and keep moving to the next thing that you have to knock down. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of sense of vulnerability that we're exposing our students to. I don't understand how parents would be wanting to send their children to spaces where they're going to be treated that way. So if protests, you know, some administrators are saying protest is the reason why you might have seen like a drop in admissions or applications. But it could also work the other way, too. That
right.
The crackdown actually is also a disincentive to parents to send their children out because their identities, who they are in the classroom and on campus will not be protected, mm-hmm. potentially.
We also heard from another student activist, Nadia Abusud, and she is a senior at St. Louis University, studying psychology and communication. She's one of the co-founders of Occupy SLU, which helped organize several protests over the past couple of years, including pro-Palestinian anti-war protests. And more recently, Nadia has been engaged in actions protesting new federal deportation policies.
I feel that activism is a privilege. And if you have the privilege to become an activist, you should, because you're helping other people who are in underprivileged communities, especially the people of Palestine currently and just the people of Congo and Sudan and everywhere else. I believe that if you have the ability to come out and show your voice, it is your freedom of speech. It may seem like it isn't right now, but it is your freedom of speech, and that is in the Constitution. Your rights should be protected. And I feel that if you want to make a difference and you want your life to make a difference, I would come out and help show support within your community to help make the world a better place.
Now, since she'll be graduating soon, Nadia is focused on preparing the next generation of college student activists for actions to come.
So we are helping with getting more people on board and continuing what we started at the university, talking about what our future is and how like we can get people to come and create a coalition and keep these like core values. Like we have like a DICE unit and like the diversity and equity, just keeping all of that inclusivity on our campus, especially with all of the threats that have been made. And we are holding like town halls and teach-ins and stuff like that on campus to help these students keep continuing to remember what our core values are.
She added that they have also taken classes on how to protect themselves from arrest and surveillance during protests.
If you are here illegally, we've been asking people to help us online so they're not at risk. And we've been telling students that if they want to go to protests in the future, that they should try and mask up due to all the facial recognition stuff that is currently happening. Even though President Trump said the whole thing about no masks and stuff like that, we still want everyone to be safe.
That was Nadia Abusud, a St. Louis University senior who spoke with senior producer Emily Woodbury about the scope of her involvement with student activism. So, Chris, if we sort of think about those developments over time, what student activists who are participating in protests have had to deal with and some of the adjustments that have had to be made, does it seem like that chilling effect, that it's going to work, or are student protesters just going to get smarter?
I think it depends on the location. Because I think if you have a tradition of protests, that I think a lot of students want to maintain that tradition. They want to stand in the light of that tradition. They don't want to run from it. But in other places where protests might be a little more sporadic or inconsistent, where there isn't that culture there, or there is one, you know, graduating class that's not as active, then in those kind of spaces you will see, you know, people just kind of minding their business, trying to go along with their studies or what have you. What I always like to remind folks is, students would rather be taking their classes and getting their work done and graduating on time. They mm-hmm. do not come there just to protest. And I think this is a misnomer of how we look at the American Academy. A lot of people who already have contempt or worry, or they're fearful, or they think they're elite spaces, think the students are just coming there to protest. But students are coming there to learn.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to advance themselves into the market of ideas and also the marketplace. So that's what the university and college has been, is a vehicle towards that end. Along the way, your awareness enhances because you're reading things that you weren't exposed to, and you're reading with a different level of depth and precision that you weren't exposed to in K through 12.
Mm-hmm.
Once that awareness happens, most conscious students want to act on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reason why you see a lot of protests, especially when you see university investments in a lot of the things that's happening around the world.
Mm-hmm. And exposure too,
that's
to
right.
people of different
that's
backgrounds.
Right. Absolutely.
And I think we certainly see that with the two students that we've heard from during this segment.
And it was protests that made the American University as diverse as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
It was protests that led to opening up the doors for women, opening up the doors for Black folk, LGBTQ rights. All of that happened through protests. And the university that we have today is not the university that it was in 1950. Unfortunately, we have a administration that you know, looks at the 1950s favorably, when a lot of folks who would be considered DEI folks were profoundly vulnerable and had to risk themselves to even get entry into a lot of these universities, mm-hmm. including in the state of Missouri.
Yeah. We started by talking about recent news, and that concerns one university, Columbia University, losing funding, and also the graduate student who has been arrested. And again, he is an American permanent resident. How much of this is about taking Columbia University and making it an example so that students all across the country, whether they're going to private or public institutions, will chill out, like, completely?
Yeah. You know, obedience is the goal, right? Get everyone in line, get everyone quiet, get everyone saying yes to whatever comes out of the White House right now. And I think that that's where the difference is between, say, the Biden administration and the Trump administration recently. You didn't sense this open contempt for the American Academy under Biden, okay? So you did have the use of force to expel people, to arrest people, to break up encampments, and the kind of policing of what they deemed anti-Semitic rhetoric to be, right? So you did have that. But the open contempt for just learning in general, that's what we're feeling under this regime right now. That's why it's on hyperspeed, even though parts of it is a continuation. The private-public situation, you know, public schools are going to be the first ones to bear the brunt of crackdown from the federal government because they, you know, use the most federal money. But obviously, the private schools also have partnership with the federal government as well, as we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Some private schools are going to be able to stand behind mission, value, their own identity, whether it's a religious institution or not, and they can hold on to that. But I think ultimately it won't be able to hold. It will be a dam that won't be able to hold. They'll have to do some kind of capitulation, if you will. But I think it is a very interesting question, and we'll have to just see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm. Chris Tinson is a professor of history and chair of African American studies at St. Louis University. Chris, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me again.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.